Mildred Wolf is important in several kind of layers. One, she was an artist in Alabama before she moved here. She knew what she wanted to be and do. And so her husband bringing her here really established a community of people when they built their little compound off Old Canton Road. It created a place that people could identify with art, could identify with art making.
By the 1960s, the Wolf Studio was becoming a pinnacle of the art movement in the Jackson community, not only due to the quality of work that both Mildred and Carl produced, but also in part to their commitment to the academic sphere of the art world. Carl took up a position at Millsaps College almost immediately upon returning home in the 1940s. Likewise, in 1958, during that three-year window in which she painted the Freedoms, Mildred began teaching at the college as well.
It was 3 days a week, I think. Then my mother started teaching art history. She taught for about 7 or 8 years art history, and she also was the first art history teacher they'd ever had. This was before still there was a department. So her class got to be, at first it was kind of an elective, and then it got to be a requirement, a part of the freshman, you know, big survey class kind of deal. So she was really interested in that and loved the subject. So she really gave it a lot.
The Wolfs collectively brought a level of expertise to the art department at Millsaps. But Mildred brought something else, something that reveals a real depth of devotion to this discipline. Not only was she a gifted technician, and not only did she impart onto others the power to tap into their creativity, but she also possessed an acute awareness of the story of art.
Carl Wolf, as a primary studio instructor, was of course a major component of that, but Mildred Wolf did teach some studio. I think in 1964 she added block printing and lithography to the studio offerings.
This is Dr. Elise Smith, professor of art history and the Sanderson Chair in Arts and Sciences at Millsaps College.
But even before that, starting in 1957, she was starting to teach an art history course. So is my great-grandma in art history. She is the immediate predecessor to me coming and teaching art history here. Lucy Millsaps did teach a little bit of art history as well, but it started with Mildred Wolf and with the recognition that any arts program needs to be set in the context of the historical development of the arts. So that means a lot to me that Mildred recognized that and instituted a course in art history here at Millsaps.
When she started preparing for the course, the college had no textbooks or slide collection. She developed the course from scratch with an overhead projector and photographs she had taken during her travels or duplicates of magazine cuttings.
The course started off small, only 8 students, but soon grew to 30. Teaching gave her the opportunity to visit Europe for the first time through Peabody College in Nashville. She spent an entire week in each of 6 cities, London, Paris, Rome, Florence, Venice, and Vienna, all the while collecting slides for her course.
The course proved so instrumental to the college's mission that it became a requirement of the pre-med and education programs. It was moved to the big lecture hall in order to hold the mass of students under her direction. But all of that came to a sharp and unexpected end. Four Freedoms is brought to you in partnership with the Mississippi Museum of Art. Located in the heart of downtown Jackson, it is the largest art museum in the state and offers programming for patrons of all ages. And the best part, admission to the museum, its exhibitions, and its beautiful gardens is free. So check it out and visit www.msmuseumart.org for more info.
Welcome to Four Freedoms. I'm Ryan Davis.
And I'm Michael Guidry. Chapter 4. Everything changes. This is part 2 of a 2-part chapter. If you haven't already listened to part 1, we encourage you to do so before continuing part 2.
I don't know if you call it firing, but it was a bad deal.
The college was evolving. It was in the process of completing a new academic complex that was to house a fresh, modern art department.
So the dean called my father in and talked to him about how it was time for him to retire because they were going to get a a whole new art department. They needed to get somebody young. And my father was quite ready to retire, and he said, fine. And there was no mention of my mother at all in this conversation. All that summer, that happened in the spring, I think, and all that summer my mother was thinking that, you know, she was going to be teaching in the fall. And she called toward the end of the summer the library to get them to talk, to start ordering books. And the library said, I don't think you're teaching here anymore.
It was 1970, and still, Mildred was unable to escape this contrived professional attachment to Carl. She had wrestled with it as an artist for decades. Now, despite all the energy and life she had breathed into the art history course, she was packaged with Carl and discarded as the college moved in a younger direction.
It turns out that they retired, both of them, and nobody ever spoke to my mother about it from Millsaps. The dean, nobody, no letter saying thank you for all these years of service and blah, blah, blah. It was just assumed that, I don't know, I guess it was assumed that that she was part of my father, and yeah, that if he was going to retire, that meant she was retiring too.
The effect of this dismissal was hard on the usually quiet and understated Mildred Wolf. It was an impact that lasted more than a decade.
She was the kind of person that it hurt her so badly, but she did not want to go make a big stink out of it. I think it embarrassed and hurt her both so badly that she never did say anything about it. I never knew about it. I never knew about it until she was an old lady and I was taking care of her. She was in her 80s.
As you may have noticed, Millsaps College has quietly become an auxiliary character in this story. We have heard from Dr. Bill Story and Dr. Stephanie Rolfe, both academics at the college. Early on, we learned about Carl's connection to the college. And now we've uncovered Mildred's lasting contribution to the college's art department, as well as her untimely dismissal.
But the extent of the college's role in this story goes slightly beyond that. Ben Stevens also had a connection to the college. In 1955, he was awarded an honorary Doctor of Laws from the college. According to his grandsons, he even served on the Board of Trustees for a time.
And then there is the personal connection. Full disclosure, I am a Millsaps alumnus. I will admit, when we began this project, I was ignorant of the role my alma mater played in this narrative. But as we began to peel back the layers, it became more evident the part Millsaps played in the little interweaving threads of our story. And I considered it a disservice to exclude this simple yet noteworthy piece of the puzzle. Because in this story, Millsaps, much like the Freedoms themselves, exists as this perplexing contradiction of sorts.
On one hand, the college has a pedigree of forward thinking. Mildred Wolf's art history class is a fitting example of that.
I am not an artist at all, and so I particularly admire her for being both an artist and an art historian, a teacher of art history. So I can't do that. But to know that she was somebody who saw that this department needs to have both strands. It needs to have the creative, hands-on making of art, but it also needs to have the intellectual, analytical way of thinking about the context of art, the larger context of art.
The idea that the college gave Mildred Wolf this opportunity and that it embraced the value her course added to its liberal arts mission is laudable, and it's lasting. Every student that walks the campus of Millsaps, whether a business major, a biology major, or a history major, will, in some manner, be exposed to art history. So, there is a sense of bewilderment that this is the same institution that so casually dismissed Mildred because her husband was retiring. That incomprehension wasn't lost on Bibi.
That was a horribly stupid, unprofessional kind of thing for them to do. Yeah. So anyway, she had to bear that. And these days, if that happened to any woman, I think even somebody of her temperament, they'd be holy hell. You'd raise holy hell. You know, it was in the 70s. And I told her she, could raise holy hell about it.
It would take over a decade to settle this offense. And we will delve into that reconciliation soon. But there was another issue that rose to the top of the nation's consciousness during the 1960s, and it was an issue that Mildred Wolfe found required prudent handling.
We've spent a lot of time at the Mississippi Museum of Art throughout the making of this podcast. We've had the opportunity to explore the galleries and experience some of the amazing programming the museum has to offer. In fact, the museum offers a wide variety of year-round educational programs for both children and adults. First, there's Museum After Hours, a family-friendly cornucopia of art, social engagement, and education. Their Hoot and Holler Family Creation Lab brings 6 to 10-year-olds and their families into the galleries and classroom to look at and create art together. For kids 5 and under, there's Look and Learn with Hoot. It emphasizes creative play and literacy through story time and hands-on art activity. On top of that, each spring and fall, the museum hosts Family Day, a Saturday morning filled with art making, story time, music, dance, and games that all connect to the artwork in the gallery. To see a full schedule of these family-friendly events and classes, as well as the complete list of exhibitions, visit msmuseumart.org.
I love Mississippi. I love her people. Our customs. I love and I respect our heritage.
This is Mississippi Governor Ross Barnett on September 29, 1962. He's speaking at an Ole Miss football game at Veterans Memorial Stadium in Jackson, and it was no coincidence that he elected to address a crowd of 40-plus thousand rebel flag-waving fans on this particular night.
For weeks, Barnett had been in regular telephone conversations with the United States Attorney General Robert Kennedy. The dialogue centered on a student named James Meredith and his efforts to enroll at the University of Mississippi. After years of legal battles, on September 13, 1962, the Fifth Circuit Court issued an injunction directing Ole Miss officials to admit Mr. Meredith without any further delay. Barnett, on multiple occasions, personally blocked James Meredith from entering the registrar's office in defiance of the federal order.
Barnett had political motives for his actions. Echoing the ghosts of the past, he championed states' rights, and he had built his campaign on a promise that his supporters fanatically held him to.
I could not depart this platform and walk from this convention hall without first reaffirming fully my absolute and unshakable stand for segregation of the races at all levels.
The reason Ross Barnett wanted to keep James Meredith from enrolling at Ole Miss was because James Meredith was black. He had already advantageously used his political clout to interfere with the Freedom Riders during the summer of 61, sending many of them to the state penitentiary in Parchman. The roar he received from the crowd that night in the vet gave him a renewed sense of affirmation.
Just past midnight on September 30th, 1962, President John F. Kennedy signed an order federalizing the Mississippi National Guard. They were deployed to Oxford, Mississippi, home of the Ole Miss campus. What ensued next were two nightmarish days of riots and violence that resulted in the death of 2 students and injury of many more.
Almost as if it occurred with the flipping of a calendar from one year to the next, this element of the social climate shot to the forefront of Mildred Wolfe's cognizance.
The decade of the 60s was a disturbing time in Mississippi. Conservative whites, led by Governor Ross Barnett, tried by every means possible to deny the black population search for equality.
Once again, these are the words of Mildred Wolfe brought to life by Marie Venters. These excerpts are made possible through special permission by the University Press of Mississippi.
Mildred started becoming more aware of the racial inequalities that surrounded her, especially as the segregationist platform grew in popularity. Schools, particularly institutions of higher education, became de facto battlegrounds for civil rights and integration. At Millsaps, where Mildred was building her art history course, leadership took a forward-thinking approach. In 1965, it became the first college in Mississippi to voluntarily integrate.
The fever pitch surrounding civil rights and integration went beyond schools, bathrooms, and buses. Churches also began weighing the moral question. Segregationists like Barnett often used the Bible to justify their position. But cracks started forming in that foundation, and Mildred Wolfe found herself at a curious intersection.
A far-sighted Methodist minister opened the doors of Jackson's largest Methodist churches to blacks, causing a large portion of the congregation to depart and form their own church. Our architect friend was in charge of building the new church and asked me to design 9 stained glass windows for it. Though I disagreed with the church's policies, artists cannot always be open about their own beliefs and still make a living. I satisfied my own mind by using only religious symbols in the design for the windows, leaving out the human element, black or white, and taking my inspiration from the medieval glass of Chartres.
50 years removed, it may be easy to perceive a choice like this as complicit. One could argue that it would have been more noble to stand on principle and refuse the commission altogether. But even though things do change, it can often be difficult to act as an agent of change when you found yourself incubated in a particular climate.
They could not publicly speak out or do any sort of action against it because it really would have blackballed their livelihood. I mean, it really would have back in those days, and I think they were aware of that.
Bridging from childhood to adolescence as the decades turned, Bibi was caught up in an innocent ignorance of the world around her. But it has become a part of her life that has received a great deal of sobering reflection.
Well, it was part of that, the air you breathed in the 50s, you know. And that made it, I guess, in some ways, if you know, to grow up sort of unconscious of the real disparity between, you know, the real oppression of black people, which is the way I grew up. I was not conscious of it. You know, it's never pointed out to me. It's just like part of the way things were. If you're going to live in a society that is so tightly, rigidly kept that way, you know, that's part of the mechanism of keeping it that way, is that if you... is to foster that sort of innocence within it. You know? Yeah. In which you can say, well, you know, I'm not a racist. I didn't ever do any of those things.
She recognizes the ignorance that consumed much of Mississippi during that period and acknowledges that what she faces now is a re-edification of sorts.
For me, it's a kind of a lifelong re-education of coming to grips with that kind of ignorance and proclivities, and how do I change that? You know, how do I see things clearly? How do I go about changing my heart, my mind, and be able to just, you know, see it all without, you know, and without casting a whole lot of blame, because you don't, you know, the people that deserve the blame. They're all dead.
For much of her life in Jackson, Mildred Wolfe was the subject of others' ignorance, especially in regard to her prowess and individuality as an artist. Her talents were questioned because of her gender, and she admittedly lived in Carl's shadow much of their life in Jackson. But she was also not immune to ignorance, which makes her another, and arguably the most compelling, dichotomous figure in this story.
Much like the subject of her paintings, Mildred simultaneously embodied the pinnacle of one principle, in this case her strong professional independence as a woman, but also a certain degree of ignorance as it pertained to the liberties of others. What we can be thankful for, though, is that we have her paintings to serve as a model of atonement and contemplation in a world constantly changing and challenging our values. In the vein of reconciliation, let us now circle back to Mildred's dismissal from Millsaps College, and the professor that helped right the wrongs of a decade past.
It became apparent to me one day when Bibi and I were having a conversation. And first of all, I should say, I love Bibi's art. I've long been a fan of her artwork. It just gets to me in a profound way.
This is Dr. Elise Smith, professor of art history and the Sanderson Chair in Arts and Sciences at Millsaps College.
You know, clearly always wanting to do anything that I could to help that family, but not knowing anything about the history of the Wolfe's involvement other than, isn't it cool that William Hollingsworth and the Wolfs were involved in the early years of the Millsaps Art Department. So I knew that, but didn't know anything more.
Baby also didn't know the details concerning her mother's departure from Millsaps until Mildred was in her later years of life. Baby had been doing some guest lecturing at the college and was searching through the slide catalog for some slides to borrow. The same slide catalog her mother spent the better part of a decade compiling. She noticed there were all these slides in the wastebasket, and they had her mother's name on them.
And it made me sad to see them, so I couldn't quite bear it to leave them in the garbage can, so I picked them all up and brought them home, and I mentioned it to my mother, because I said, I guess they're cleaning out the slide catalog up there, because they're throwing some of these away. And that sparked her telling me this story, that she had been fired at the same time they'd asked my father to retire, but nobody ever, ever, ever told her anything about it.
So Bibi went to Millsaps to speak with someone she thought could put the situation to rights.
So I went back up to Millsaps and talked to Elise Smith, who's the head of the art department there, and I told her the whole story.
It was almost serendipitous that Elise Smith be the one to reconcile this wrong. Her story paralleled that of Mildred's in a specific and appropriate way.
I came on the coattails of my husband when we came to Millsaps. He got the job first, Steve did, in the philosophy and religious studies departments. And I started teaching adjunct one course at a time and then working into more teaching. And so I really understand what it's like for, you know, traditionally for women to, you know, have to kind of tuck themselves in where they can in terms of the sorts of careers that were seen as most suited for men.
Dr. Smith was both shocked and saddened by the story that Bibi relayed to her. Then Bibi suggested what could be done to settle the matter.
And I said, I'm telling you the story because what I want you to do is to write her a letter from you as the head of the art department, expressing some gratitude for everything she did during her time as teaching there and beginning the art history class, because nobody ever taught it before, creating the whole slide library, you know, the resources and everything, and just send it to her. Just send her this. I'm not going to tell her that I asked you to do it, but she has never gotten any recognition from Millsaps at all. No thank you, no gratitude, no nothing for all the years she taught there.
That just hit me really hard. I thought, oh, that is not the way it should be. We should be reveling in that connection. We should be honoring that connection.
So Elise Smith honored Bibi's request and composed a letter to Mildred Wolf.
And it came about a week later, and I said, oh, there's a letter from Millsaps. And she opened it, and she said, oh, well, they finally did do something.
In typical fashion, Mildred was quiet and unassertive in her reaction. So much so that Bibi had to convince her to include this event in her published memoir.
She was reluctant to put it in the book, but I asked her, I said, no, you've got to do this. This is your life. This is what happened to you. It has to be in there. People have to see that this is the way women were treated.
Mildred's experience at Millsaps is congruent with a good deal of her professional life in Jackson. It's unfair to call it a struggle because Mildred Wolf succeeded in a manner many like her wouldn't have. Hers is a story, to use Bibi's words, of forceful determination. It was that quality in her that fueled her accomplishments as an artist. It was also the quality that allowed her to skillfully navigate the social obstacles she's faced.
While her legacy was not something she worried about, it is a legacy worth acknowledging and celebrating. If we have learned anything about Mildred Wolf's intentions as an artist, it is that she wanted to produce works that had a voice. And that is true of both her art and her academic contributions to the art community.
I think that both Wolfs not only saw themselves as artists, as they surely did, but that they also saw a very important role for them as teachers. And so Millsaps, you know, they were teaching in a lot of different ways, but Millsaps as the sort of institutional framework for teaching, being able to acknowledge that was important for us.
That brings us back to the Freedoms themselves, the four painted Masonite panels that made their way from the B.M. Stevens store to the Perry County Courthouse. They were well taken care of during their time at the courthouse, but their purpose was being lost. They were all the way up on the third floor, and the only people that saw them were court officials and people on trial. So the descendants of Ben Stevens decided a change was needed.
So at some point when I was in there, like I tell you, and we just got to talking as a family, particularly Benjamin and I, and then we got a hold of the museum here.
It was 2013, 4 years after Mildred Wolfe's death. She would never get to see her paintings installed permanently, but her daughter would be an instrumental factor in getting them to the museum.
He called me up, and he said that the family was trying to figure out how the final disposition of some things, and that was one of the things they were trying to decide about, and they were still in the courthouse. And he said, "What do you think should happen to those paintings?" And I said, "I think they should be in the museum."
From there, the ball got moving quickly.
So I was contacted by a member of the Stevens family who owned the paintings, who commissioned the paintings from Mildred Wolfe.
Again, this is Betsy Bradley, director of the Mississippi Museum of Art.
And they said that they were in this courthouse, but, you know, there wasn't a lot of traffic. And because of generational kind of turnover in their family, wanted to make sure as the next generation gained ownership of this work that it really was seen by the public, because it's got such a public message. And so we worked with them to carefully remove them from the courthouse, to bring them here, and then we had them cleaned and conserved so that they could sparkle when they were put on display.
The Four Freedoms now hang in permanent display in the main corridor adjacent the museum's galleries. The families were reunited at the installation ceremony in the spring of 2014. It was a very fitting end to a nearly 60-year journey.
And there is a great consensus among all those involved that Mildred Wolfe's Four Freedoms are where they belong.
You know, myself, the reason I wanted it up here was that just like it is now, you know, with my grandkids or great-grandkids, if they decide to come in here, you know, they can see the freedom, read the article about, you know, their great-great-great-grandfather, where it may be. And that's just a place. They were just too pretty for not somebody to see them.
Enjoy them.
Yeah, to enjoy them. And here is the most logical place.
It's great that the museum had that perfect space so they fit, which nothing much was happening with. All this happened after my mother's death, so she would have been so pleased that they ended up in the public part of the museum, mm-hmm. you know, so that they really belong. Yeah. Where they are where they belong.
Obviously, it's public art made by one of Mississippi's great artists, and so the fact that we can house that at the Mississippi Museum of Art and use them in telling the story of Mississippi's art story, the story of a particular artist who thrived in Mississippi and was a leader in the cultural community is really important.
Mildred Wolfe's Four Freedoms are foremost works of art, and astonishing ones at that. Even without knowing their story, you can stand in front of them and be deeply engaged by the discourse they offer. And that, in and of itself, also makes them a valuable part of the museum's public mission to invite and encourage art literacy.
I love these works because they're a little bit abstracted in some panels, but then some are more figurative and realistic. But I love Mildred Wolfe's use of color and line in these pieces.
This, again, is Isabel Gray, the James and Madeline McMullen Director of School and Academic Programs at the Mississippi Museum of Art. The Freedoms are especially effective with the school groups she regularly encounters.
Kids are really good at picking up on that when we use this for tours. They notice how we talk about the colors and the lines and what it makes them feel. And I think it's just such a good piece to look at the way those things can affect the overall mood and meaning of a painting, especially taking it panel by panel with the text. It kind of makes it, you know, a little bit easier with those big words on the side. They know what it's referencing, and so it kind of makes it easier to kind of talk about that, discuss that. But yeah, it's a really great one to use with kids for that purpose.
In that same approach, simply standing alone, Mildred's Freedoms have the ability to draw conversation from even the most casual observer. The engaging combination of color and line sees you. The large but delicate print along the borders modestly bestow context to each panel. they are an exercise in tireless and timeless expression.
So I was always aware of that and proud of her and impressed by the seriousness of it, of the expression itself, that it really means something. That it's, you know, not a lightweight thing. It's not a throwaway thing. It's an enduring expression of something important to the nation, to the country.
Betsy Bradley also recognizes the capability of these works to endure and articulate our shared principles.
We have a public purpose, and we feel that we have a civic role to play, and that is having conversations about what important values are in our city, in our state, and in our country. And the values proclaimed in these works of art are not values that were just important in 1941 or 1954. They are values that continue to be threatened in all places in our country and around the world, and we cannot take them for granted.
She considers art, and especially these paintings, as a uniquely profound way to elevate these ideals to the forefront of our communal awareness.
And we need to hold those values up to our leaders at every opportunity. And I think that the way artists can convey civic messages reaches an individual who walks into the museum at a more profound level than speech-making can, or perhaps even policy makers can. Their beauty makes them appeal to an individual in a very spiritual kind of way, in a rational way, but also in a sub-rational way, where it kind of invades our consciousness and makes us understand in a deeply personal and emotional way the content that the artist was trying to convey.
And for Betsy Bradley, and by extension the museum, the ability of art to stimulate our compassion and our humanity serves a greater civic purpose. In this vein, she likes to cite Percy Shelley and his A Defense of Poetry and how it applies to artists of all forms.
He calls them the unacknowledged legislators of man. And what I think he's saying there is that artists appeal to compassion and imagination. That doesn't necessarily change laws, but it changes who we are as a culture and as a people. And that's more profound in some ways because that determines how we treat each other. That determines what our daily lives look like, what our business practices are. And it does, in fact, ultimately influence how we vote. And so calling artists the unacknowledged legislators of man to me is head on what the power of art in all of its manifestations really is.
It is a power that Mildred Wolfe's Four Freedoms encapsulate. They are compelling works that not only embody the freedoms from President Roosevelt's speech, they and their story are also relevant examples of the freedoms they represent. And that story, as we hope we have revealed, provides an added sense of gravity and resonance. On one hand, there is the role of Ben Stevens and his fidelity to public art.
He himself was, he was an unusual fellow, really a self-made man. And at a time, his whole, you know, building of his strength and position, you know, all came about at a time when that kind of ingenuity and that kind of original thinking was just like, you know, that look where it'll get you. I mean, you know, it just, you know, is amazing to in any place to find that kind of, you know, that kind of drive and energy and originality.
Their presence here is meaningful in several different ways. One, it does document this moment when there was a family so committed to the health of the democracy and the civic place that they commissioned work not just about their own industry, not just about their family members, but work about the values of this country. And that kind of civic leadership is something that we want to recognize and commend.
On the other hand, there is the theme of the Four Freedoms themselves and our perpetual struggle to preserve and protect them. In this story alone, we have only briefly touched on some of our failures to uphold and embody these values as a community. What these paintings provide us is a medium to thoughtfully reflect on our past and examine the present, to inquire and search for answers, to consider the degree with which we uphold and betray these noble principles.
And lastly, there's Mildred Wolfe, whose story bonds all of these elements together. She wasn't a Mississippian by birth, but she came to call it home. The Wolfe Studio still stands on that same patch of land north of the city. BB still produces work out of it and has her own studio on the grounds. It's where we interviewed her for this podcast. When she talks about her mother, she emits joy and pride, and she appreciates the role her home state, despite the obstacles it presents, played in this story.
I think the story is such a Mississippi story, every aspect of it, to have Ben Stevens have this idea in the first place, to have these in his store. It's just like, you know, where did that come from? I mean, it's, you know, it could happen anywhere, but it happened here. And that makes it, that makes it pretty wonderfully Mississippi. I love it that Mississippi claims that it happened here, that this is part of Mississippi, what Mississippi is, you know. And I think it's, like I say, unusual anywhere you find it, but when it's here, it's like, oh, wow.
It is a uniquely Mississippi story. The state, much like many of the characters in it, is a living paradox. It is a flawed place with a complex and difficult past. But out of those flaws often come subtle treasures. Gifts to the world shaped by the struggles of those trying to speak to our better values. So with that, we leave you with our final words from Mildred Wolfe.
My children and grandchildren sometimes say I have wisdom, but if I have any, it was gained by hindsight. Everything changes. I owe a lot of people for their gifts to me, although often they didn't know they were giving them. The greatest gift of all was the gift of Carl's love, and the love and respect of my children. As for my paintings, I will let them speak for themselves.
This has been Four Freedoms. Thank you for listening. Four Freedoms is brought to you by PK Media with support from the Mississippi Museum of Art. It was researched by Michael Guidry and Ryan Davis, written by me, Michael Guidry, produced by Sonny Sweat, editing and sound engineering by Ed Foos, original title score and composition by Steve Smith. It was recorded at PK Media Studios in Jackson, Mississippi. We would like to thank Marie Venters for lending her voice to give life to Mildred Wolfe's words. Excerpts featured in this episode were made possible through cooperation with the University Press of Mississippi. We would like to extend our deepest gratitude to BB Wolfe for her time and invaluable insight during the making of this series. We also encourage you to visit the Wolfe Studio on Old Canton Road in Jackson to experience and celebrate the artistic contributions of the entire Wolfe family. We would like to recognize Richard Joel and David Toms for their support and involvement in this story. We would also like to thank Dr. Stephanie Rolfe and Dr. Lee Smith of Millsaps College, as well as Isabel Gray and Betsy Bradley of the Mississippi Museum of Art for their contributions to this episode. For more information about this episode, visit fourfreedoms.pkpods.com. That's the number 4, freedoms.pkpods.com. To experience the Four Freedoms paintings in person, we encourage you to visit the Mississippi Museum of Art. Admission is free. Or visit their website, www.msmuseumart.org. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the series, please share, subscribe, and leave a review. That's all for now, but we urge you to continue to check your feed for upcoming bonus material.